Welcome back to session two of Depression and Anxiety Recovery. We're going to be speaking about how to optimize our brain connections, our brain chemistry, as well as the hardware of our brain. And there's exciting research that I will be revealing, particularly in the area of what we call lifestyle medicine. Some of the most new and exciting research in all of medicine is in this area of what's called lifestyle medicine that we actually used to call alternative medicine. Why was it called alternative medicine? Because traditional medicine, looking at pharmaceuticals and randomized controlled trials, this was seen as the gold standard. But now we realize that there are better therapies than the traditional ones that have actually been proven to be even more effective. And so it really can't be called alternative medicine anymore. It's called lifestyle medicine, and there's more scientific information in many areas of medicine that support the idea of lifestyle medicine being superior to traditional medicine, or if they're used together, they're called complementary medicine. And when it comes to mental health, we might call traditional medicine marginal medicine because it does improve things, but marginally often in comparison with some of the simple things that you're going to learn today to improve your brain health. One of the most prime things that can help us is simply being outdoors. There are many benefits of being outside in nature. One of them is fresh air. When we're in a gym exercising, there is confined areas. Yes, we hope that the gym has some good air filtering systems and we're getting in better air there, but it's actually better to be outside. Fresh air improves our focus, and the negative ions that are present in fresh air can have even better benefits. It improves learning and concentration. It's been shown to reduce anxiety. It's been shown to improve mood significantly. Where do we find more of these negative ions? It's actually where there is moving natural water. The ocean surf has plenty. This is why people like to buy beach houses and be out there where that ocean surf is crashing with that fresh air. Waterfalls, beautiful to look at, but also just basking in that environment of that waterfall is going to help our brain as we hike. If you live in an area where there are thunderstorms, I recommend you don't go out there when there's lightning and thunder, but as soon as it's over with, get outside and take that deep breath, and you will actually feel invigorated right away from that one deep breath of breathing in those negative ions that were produced actually as a result of the thunderstorm. But you can even get it in areas that don't have moving water if you're around evergreen trees. Evergreen trees actually, in the way they breathe, they emit negative ions and they help us in many ways in our brain. There have been a number of studies in Denmark and other areas showing the more we live around natural green spaces, the better health we have in 15 different common diseases. And one of those diseases that has the greatest benefit is actually the mental diseases. Notice growing up near green spaces has been associated with a 15 to 55% decreased risk of developing psychiatric illnesses in adulthood, depending upon the specific illness. And where the best results are, the 55%, happens to do with depression and anxiety. That green space effect is dose dependent, meaning the more we have those natural settings that we're out in, the better the response in our brain health. Spending at least 120 minutes a week in nature is associated with better health and well-being. That means it doesn't have to be all day. If you're out there all day, that's great. Of course, we'll talk about some of the how we can even have more advantages the more time we're in it. But 120 minutes, if you divide that up, that's like a little more than 10 minutes a day, and you are having significant measurable benefits as long as it's 120 minutes a week.
Adolescents who spend time in green spaces have reduced stress, better emotional well-being, less depression, and improved mental health as well. So the scientific literature is describing being outside as nature-based interventions, if you want to look it up and find out more about this. And nature-based interventions improve depression and anxiety, also improve our ability to manage stress in our life, and reduce negative rumination. This is something that people with depression and anxiety have. We call it negative automatic thoughts. And just being outside in nature is going to reduce our negative automatic thoughts in this cycle of repetitively thinking on a negative way. Improving our focus, improving our sleep as well, and inducing more physical exercise. One of the things I've noticed when you're outside, it's not natural to just stand there. When you're outside in nature, you want to walk around, you want to experience it, you want to see more of it, you want to interact with it. And it's not like indoors where people are staying in one spot for long periods of time as they're interacting with devices or being a couch potato in front of a television. Interestingly, it also reduces the use of technology. And that is a big bonus. We're going to talk about the disadvantages of technology usage the way it's normally used today as far as brain health. In fact, it's even hard to interact with a screen outside because it's so bright outside that you can't really see it that well, and that's a good thing. If you want to get to the best areas, though, of being out in nature, gardening is where it's at. There are a number of positive health effects of gardening. Gardening has been shown to reduce depression and anxiety and reduce your waistline. In other words, you're expending more calories. You're not going to eat as much high-fat food when you're out there. In fact, you're going to tend to eat more plant-based because that's what you're growing out in the garden. It's been shown to increase life satisfaction, increase your quality of life, as well as your sense of self-worth being out there in the garden. The Japanese have come up with a phrase that they've been studying called forest bathing. And there are some positive mental effects of forest bathing. Now, this isn't where you're actually getting outside in a tub in the forest and bathing. It's actually just being out there in the forest and walking in that forest. Researchers found that walking for 2 hours in a mixed natural forest environment improved a number of things compared with those who were randomized not to walk in that forest. Tension and anxiety improved, depression and dejection improved, anger and hostility improved, energy levels went up, fatigue improved, less confusion, and additionally, forest bathing changed negative mood states to positive mood ones. And this is exactly what we want to do. With depression and anxiety, the typical person is going to have about 80% of their time spent in a negative mood state or more. And if we can switch it over to a positive mood state, this will help us greatly in alleviating these mental health conditions. It also had an effect on brain chemistry itself. It increased serotonin levels. And we'll talk a little bit about how this can happen because just being out in a forest, increasing serotonin levels, well, you'll get into the details of why this occurs. Forest bathing also helps us in non-mental health ways, like lowering blood pressure in those with hypertension. It improves autonomic function. It improves your immune system in addition. And less respiratory allergies, not more. And of course, it improves mood and stress, and it's also been shown to improve attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. In fact, for students that are having problems with ADHD, one of the solutions is getting them outside in nature and interacting with nature. Today, ADHD will occur in virtually every child if they are raised the way our culture is trying to raise them. They don't even have to have a genetic basis for it. How do they get into ADHD so readily? It's actually the screens. And the screens drive you to distraction. They might be on the screen to do their homework. You think, that's a good thing. They're doing their homework. But within 3 minutes, they're no longer doing their homework. What happened? Well, maybe the technology companies realized they liked BMWs. And so there's a BMW that floats across the screen. And a new BMW is available at the local dealership that they may not know all the details of. And they're thinking, oh, it won't take me long to figure out about this BMW. They click on this, and then there's more interesting things that have to do with this. And before they know it, they're there a half hour, and they've only worked on their homework for 2 minutes. Before they got distracted. It can be even worse than that. They may actually get on their phone to look something up that's useful for them, and as soon as they get on their phone, they realize someone text messaged them, then there's a Snapchat picture that came in, and they've done about 5 things on their phone, and then they're trying to think, why did I pick this up to begin with? The area of our brain that requires focus attention is identical to the area of our brain managing distressing emotions. And if they're not taught to be able to pay attention deeply for long periods of time, they will not be able to manage their emotions. And so ADHD is a significant issue because it always branches over into other emotional issues until we can build our focus and concentration. And being out in nature helps us to build that focus and concentration. It's one of the best therapies for ADHD that is often neglected today. In addition, being out in the forest, it improves our sense of awe, our sense of gratitude. It's easier actually to develop gratitude lists when we're out in nature. And so some of these things, like we talked about last time, building gratitude has synergistic effects with future things that you will learn about. Forest bathing is one of those. So why does it work so well? One of the reasons is because the forests are emitting oils that help us. Every plant actually emits oils into the atmosphere. And some of those plant oils have been well studied in design trials in randomized controlled ways, like we study pharmaceuticals. And this is an interesting and broad area that is starting to get a lot more research. What are some of the oils that have helped us as far as depression is concerned? One of them is Celexon. Celexon is an oil that comes from the lavender plant. And whether you inhale that oil or whether you ingest it, it is shown to have antidepressant properties. Bergamot is another one with antidepressant properties. This is an oil released from a citrus that is from Central America. And it also has been shown to lower cholesterol when we ingest it. Sandalwood actually is not from the plant, the green portion of the plant. The sandalwood is from the wood itself. And even if that sandalwood is 100 years old and it hasn't been tampered with, when we get into that sandalwood, the oil is still there. And that oil, as we breathe it in, can have antidepressant properties that have been well proven in controlled trials. Mint, coming from peppermint, also has antidepressant properties. And sweet almond also is an oil that has antidepressant properties. And where we utilize this in our program is when it comes to the massage. You can have that sweet almond oil massaged in, and that aroma itself, the massage can help, plus the aroma of the sweet almond can also help in having mood-elevating properties. And these things don't have the side effects. When we're dealing with the pharmaceutical agents, we're dealing with foreign substances that can have some unwanted side effects. And it's kind of amazing. People are going to all sorts of things that have significant risks to try to improve their depression. When we're looking at these things, we're talking about risk-free. Notice pine needle extract shows up there as well. So it not only has that negative ion that helps to rejuvenate us, but it's actually antidepressant as well. Anxiety, some of them not only help depression, but anxiety. Celexon actually first was shown to help anxiety before we did trials in regards to depression. Yuzu is also an oil that's been shown to be helpful. Limonene. Helpful, and linalool also from a citrus, and linoleyl acetate as well. Now, Livella is the trade name that came from the molecule called Selexon 80. And it's been shown to contain significant anxiety-relieving properties, notice, without sedation, addiction, or frontal lobe suppression. Why is that mentioned? Because the most common anxiety-relieving drugs that are used today that can have almost an instant effect are called the benzodiazepines. These medicines will actually suppress your frontal lobe, they will sedate you some, and they will set you up for addiction. Why do they set you up for addiction? Because they're filling GABA receptors, and as those GABA receptors are filled, the brain says, I don't need to make GABA anymore. And so it quits its GABA production, and so if you end up stopping your lorazepam a month after taking it, your anxiety level is now going to be tenfold worse than before you started because now there's no GABA production manufacturing plant. Selexon does not do that. It actually has been shown, for instance, one of the forms of anxiety is test anxiety. We see this a lot in universities where students will study hard, but then they're just so worried about the test that they end up doing poorly because of their test anxiety. So we take these individuals and we give them lorazepam before the test. Their anxiety before the test is much relieved, but their scores actually get worse. Why? Their frontal lobe. They can't problem solve on it because of the frontal lobe suppression. But we give them Selexon, their anxiety gets better. In fact, it's actually been studied in comparison with a lorazepam, showing about 80 milligrams of Selexon is worth about a quarter milligram of lorazepam, and their test scores go up. They feel better, but their frontal lobe is actually working better as a result of the alleviation of anxiety, and they improve. It's also been found to have an antidepressant effect on top of it, and it's been shown to increase serotonin release and extracellular brain serotonin levels. So this is why forest bathing and being outside can improve your brain chemistry, because it's the interaction with these oils that are actually helping us to improve our serotonin levels. Even smelling it helps, but it's most effective and predictable when taken orally. Deep breathing itself has some significant advantages, and this is a lot easier to do out in nature. It can relax the body. It can oxygenate the brain for clear thinking, can help prevent respiratory infections, and it induces sound sleep. It improves mood. There are additional benefits. When we use our diaphragm to breathe slowly and deep and rely on that diaphragm, it will combat a relative of anxiety, which is rapid, shallow breaths. If you have anxiety, without you even knowing it, sometimes you're going to be breathing more frequently, and also those shallow breaths. Maintaining good posture, taking stretch breaks often, getting exercise whenever you can will aid proper breathing and maintain healthy lungs. So there have actually been controlled trials on this as well. This was a simple controlled trial, but it took a number of individuals and it said, would you be willing to undergo breathing exercises? Or would you like to be randomized maybe to non-breathing exercises? You had to agree to participate in the study whether you were going to breathe deeply or not. And so they randomized these individuals. And the trial was for 8 weeks, just as long as our program is designed here. And they were taught to breathe no more than one breath every 15 seconds. That's four breaths a minute. The only way you can breathe four times a minute and not get short of breath is to breathe deeply. So you just take out your stopwatch and you breathe very deeply. Usually you want to breathe about 6 seconds in. In fact, we might have everyone stand up that's watching this too, and if you're here in the auditorium, you can stand up as well. And let's just take a good 6 second breath in. So we'll breathe all the way out. And now let's breathe in. 1001, 1002, 1003, 1004, 1005, 1006. Just hold it for a little bit, and now breathe out. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Let's breathe in again. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Hold it for a 7 second, and then let's breathe out. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And another breath in. Hold it. Now out. And one more. Hold it. And then out. So how often did they do that? 4 breaths per minute for just 15 minutes. You've already done 1 minute. So if you practice that and do that 15 minutes, just 4 breaths a minute, you'll notice if you have an oximeter on you that your oxygen saturation is going up. And just doing those exercises 3 days a week for 15 minutes, you would think, that's not going to produce much benefit. How in the world would you be able to get much benefit with that? But in compared with the group that was randomized to not do the deep breathing, their mood improved, their anxiety improved, their focus improved, their attention improved, and even their blood cortisol levels improved. So objective measures of improvement just with this simple measure. In addition, there have been more studies now on contrast baths. This is known as hydrotherapy. Series of short, repeated immersions in water alternating between hot and cold temperatures. Sometimes the cold temperatures are called cryotherapy in the medical literature. And this is used in sports medicine, athletic training, rehab settings, and it's also used in the mental health setting. It increases blood flow and oxygenation to tissue. It decreases swelling and stiffness. It promotes healing, improves limb function, quickens recovery, but it's also been shown to improve depression. In fact, we call this natural shock therapy. Now, you know what shock therapy is in the traditional sense. This is where we actually do general anesthesia on someone and induce a seizure to try to get them out of their severe treatment-resistant depression, which has significant side effects where they lose memory that they'll never be able to regain of things that have happened to them in the past in kind of a randomized manner. This natural shock treatment has no side effects like that. It will actually help your memory. And we've noticed even improvement in psychosis. For those that have schizophrenia, the cryotherapy for a longer period of time can actually temporarily normalize their psychosis. And it can have an antidepressant effect similar to the ECT treatments without the side effects. Light also has a role in mental health that has been largely neglected today, despite the many studies showing benefit. It's an effective antidepressant. It has to be bright enough light. We're talking about thousands of lux of light through the eyes that initiates our serotonin production. And it's been shown to not only treat major depression, but seasonal affective disorder won't even come about if you have enough light. It gives results equivalent to the standard antidepressants called the SSRIs for non-seasonal depression, but it works quicker than the SSRIs. It works best for those who also have fatigue or low energy associated with their depression, or for those who have a tendency to eat or sleep too much. We talked about hypersomnia being one of the major symptoms of depression, and this really helps the hypersomnia so you don't have that need for all of that extra sleep. It's been shown to work for partum and postpartum depression, and interestingly, it works great for bipolar depression. We talked about how severe bipolar depression can be, and a simple therapy like light therapy can start to lift the mood very quickly in bipolar depression. It actually responds much more quickly than medication, and it can be used with or without medication. So once again, we call it complementary medicine, where we can use it with traditional medicine or in the place of medicine. So the studies have actually shown how much light we need. 2,500 lux for 2 hours in the morning. What's 2,500 lux? That's if you go outside on a cloudy day, you're going to get about 2,500 lux, as long as it's not really dark rain clouds. If it's dark rain clouds, it might only be 300 lux. But most indoors are less than 300 lux, and that's not enough to produce the positive effect in brain chemistry. 5,000 lux for an hour in the morning can be enough to produce that significant response. Or if you're outside in sunlight, you're going to get 10,000 lux or more, and you only need 30 minutes. So we've actually helped in patients by getting them medical-grade light boxes. These are something that anyone can purchase. The traditional light boxes were actually white light boxes, and they emitted maybe 10,000 lux of white light, shown to be very healthy and beneficial, particularly first thing in the morning. But if it's just the blue wavelength of light, that's between 450 and 490 nanometers, you only need less than 1,000 lux, maybe 100 to 1,000 lux, because it's the blue light that's initiating the production of serotonin. We talk about blue light being bad. That's in the evening, because that will prevent us from making melatonin in the evening. But it actually helps us to make serotonin in the morning. And without it being that bright, there's not really the worrisome side effects of too bright a light in regards to the eyes. Bright light therapy device is best placed not right in front of you, but offset 20 or 30 degrees, because it's the rods of the eyes, the peripheral vision, that interacts with our brain and produces these positive effects. So 20 to 45 degrees instead of straight ahead is better, and about 18 inches away from one of these devices is best. Researchers found that men who were exposed to an hour of bright light from one of these boxes, first thing in the morning, experience an increase in luteinizing hormone. Luteinizing hormone is a brain hormone from the pituitary gland that influences hormones in both men and women. In men, it drives up testosterone levels. A lot of men are told if they have low testosterone levels, they need to get shots. It's much better to get your own testosterone. And one of the ways of doing that is an hour of bright light first thing in the morning. We can often double those testosterone levels. And it will trigger ovulation in women and those who are not ovulating because they don't have enough luteinizing hormone. It's been also shown to help with depression. It can improve libido and has a muscle building and strengthening effect. When women with long and irregular menstrual cycles are exposed to bright light, the cycles actually regularize in most women. The problem is the average American spends over 90% of their time indoors. Another significant advantage, and this is brand new information from our previous programs, is half of the light that we get from the sun, we don't actually see. It's outside of the color spectrum. Now, we know about ultraviolet light because that produces vitamin D, and that has some benefits in mental health. But it has to be bright enough sun and direct sun to get vitamin D. But there is something that's very important, maybe even more important, and that is infrared light. Infrared light won't burn you at all, like the ultraviolet light does. Half of the photons are in the infrared area, and they are going through our clothes. They can happen even at sunrise and sunset. We can even get them off the sun shining from the trees. We won't get them from buildings. And this infrared light has some significant advantages. One of those advantages, it will help our cells produce more antioxidants. It's doing that by increasing what we call intracellular melatonin. The cumulative effect of this antioxidant reservoir enhances the body's ability to rapidly deal with changing conditions throughout the day. Now, we know about melatonin from night because our brains make this in our pineal gland in response to darkness. This is why you don't want to sleep with light in your room. You want to have it dark so that you can make melatonin, which circulates throughout your body and helps you be rejuvenated at night. But we didn't know that melatonin could be produced by our cells in daytime. Melatonin is 30 times more potent than the most potent antioxidant vitamin, which is vitamin E. And when it does this, it protects our mitochondria, our energy-producing cells are better, and it helps in a number of other ways as well. So let's talk about some of the benefits of near-infrared therapy. You can also buy LED lights that emit these infrared photons in the area of 700 nanometers to 2500 nanometers. That's different than your infrared saunas. That is your far infrared that's heating your body up. But near infrared has some significant advantages. It boosts metabolism. It prevents the mitochondria from burning out. So there's longevity and energy advantages throughout the day. It improves cognitive performance from post-traumatic brain injury. In fact, this is something that we have found very helpful for those who have had brain injury. The infrared doesn't burn, doesn't have any known adverse effects at all. None have been shown as to this date, but it can actually even penetrate the brain if it's close enough and start to heal that brain post-traumatic brain injury. It reduces PTSD symptoms and also reduces inflammation within the body in a number of different ways, even providing pain relief. Well, when we talk about the sun, many people are concerned about sunburns, but let me just tell you that if your shadow is longer than you are when you go out in the sun, you really don't have to worry about the sunburns. I was up in Tahoe in January skiing, and the lift operator was saying, everybody needs to put their sunscreen on. It's going to be a sunny day. You guys are going to get burned. In Tahoe, in the wintertime, your shadow never gets shorter than you are. Why is that? Because you're too far north and you're not going to have enough ultraviolet light to burn. And so many people are putting sunscreen on first thing in the morning. They're putting it on throughout the day. They only need it when the sun is high enough, which is normally going to be more summertime sun between like 10 and 3 in the afternoon. But we do want you to avoid the sunburn. Sunburn is not healthy as well. And so, but we don't need to do sunscreen all day. In fact, we can prevent the infrared advantages because that sunscreen can also block the infrared interaction with our skin. So let's get into circadian rhythm hits. You have a circadian rhythm hit, a biological rhythm hit, if you have regular insomnia, early morning awakenings, sleeping more than 9 hours a day routinely, sleeping less than 6 hours a day routinely, or if you're on shift work where you're constantly changing your work schedules, maybe working nights and then afternoons and then days. Many people don't have shift work, but they don't have regular hours for sleeping and eating. And that will also produce a circadian rhythm hit that will adversely affect our brain. Up to 90% of cases of major depression are accompanied by sleep disturbances. And non-depressed people with insomnia have twice the risk of developing depression compared with those who don't have sleep difficulties. But up to 90% of individuals with anxiety experience sleep disturbances, especially the insomnia where they hit the pillow and their mind keeps going because of their anxiety. Insufficient sleep can be a cause of further exacerbation of anxiety. And if you have sleep anxiety, in other words, you're worried about sleep, you aren't going to get enough sleep. And so you need to be careful in regards to that as well. So when we look at depression and insomnia, insomnia is characterized by difficulty falling asleep, staying asleep, or waking too early. And chronic insomnia is disrupted sleep that occurs at least 3 nights per week and lasts at least 3 months. We really don't start getting into more of the serious complications unless it's a long-term thing. So if you don't sleep well for one night or two, don't panic about that. It's the long-term effects of not sleeping over the period of months that's more concerning. Early morning awakening is waking up several hours before you intended your wake time to be, and you're unable to go back to sleep. If you wake up early and you're able to go back to sleep within 30 minutes, we don't consider that early morning awakening. What is the optimal sleep duration? It's between 6 and 9 hours if you're an adult, and the average female needs 7 hours and 30 minutes of sleep per night as an adult. The average male needs about 10 minutes more, 7 hours and 40 minutes, but some can get by very well with 6 and some might need 9. Hypersomnia is characterized by excessive daytime sleepiness. So how can we improve sleep? One of the best ways is that light box. It resynchronizes the biological clock when we use it at the same time every morning upon awakening. It'll take 7 days. I can take any nighttime person and turn them into a morning time person utilizing a light box by getting that light at 6 a.m. or maybe even before. It will enhance your alertness throughout the day. It assists in sleep induction at bedtime and improves the deep sleep or delta wave sleep. Plus, it also improves brain serotonin production. And when we have more serotonin in the daytime, we can have more melatonin at night, which is that rest and rejuvenate antioxidant nighttime hormone. This therapy is well tolerated, far better than drugs. And I don't recommend getting it for resetting your circadian rhythm after 6:30. Studies show if you get it after 7, yeah, it's improving your serotonin levels, but it's not setting your circadian rhythm unless you're using it early enough. So awaken with the sun or be exposed to at least 30 minutes of bright light immediately upon awakening. And in winter depression, when you're living too close to the Arctic Circle and not close enough to the equator, you may need a light box in the wintertime because the sun isn't going to be there at 6 a.m. when you wake up. Now, if you're waking up too early and not being able to go back to sleep, studies show you can use that light therapy for 2 hours at night from 8 to 10 p.m. for just 2 nights, and that will delay your circadian rhythm so you can start staying asleep. In addition, when we're outside in nature, getting physical exercise is important. How much do you need? A reminder, 60 minutes of cardio exercise per day. And the best time to do it, if at all possible, is pre-breakfast. There's an advantage to exercising even to exhaustion pre-breakfast after, and then getting a healthy breakfast, and it builds up our reserves in our brain. And we also want to decrease our screen time. Particularly in the evening, electronic devices emit shortwave blue light, which is going to stop or decrease your melatonin production and even decrease your sleepiness. So you'll be staying up and you don't even realize it's bedtime when you're on your device. So we recommend you set a time not only for bedtime, but at least an hour before that, no screens. You can read printed books, but not screens. Blue light in the evening is going to decrease your rapid eye movement sleep, which helps your frontal lobe. Extended periods of electronic device usage during the day also will negatively impact sleep. And restricting electronic usage before bed effectively improves your sleep onset. In other words, you'll go to sleep quicker. It will increase the amount of sleep you're able to have, less early morning awakening. Your quality of sleep will go up, better delta wave and REM wave sleep, and it will reduce your pre-sleep arousal. Reducing electronic bedtime must include getting rid of the apps as well in the evening. And I would recommend if you absolutely have to use a device, maybe it's an emergency, that you use a blue light filter. Either get those blue light glasses that block it off or does not emit blue. It's still not as good as not using the device at all, but at least you won't have as much blue light causing problems with your sleep. Additional tips for improving insomnia: have a quiet environment, or if your environment is not quiet, use white noise. You can get a white noise generator, and just having that roar in the room can help induce sleep. And another advantage is if you are able to be still. A lot of people toss and turn when they have problems sleeping. We have found it better to find a comfortable position and hold that position for at least 20 minutes. And if you're not asleep, then find a new comfortable position, hold that for another 20 minutes. If you're still not asleep, then do it yet a third time. If you're not asleep after the third time, we do recommend you read a printed book with a dim light until you have little tiny sleeps that we call micro sleeps. This is where your eyes are open, but you realize you lost what you were reading. And if you go to sleep then, you will then be definitely asleep within those 20 minutes. And so sleeping in a closed environment, close your eyes, sleeping in a dark room, and then use a basic alarm clock. It's better not to have your device in the room, actually. So we recommend the old-fashioned alarm clock so you're not tempted to utilize that thing in the middle of the night and get all that blue light. And so not sleeping with the phone in your room is ideal. Having regular hours for sleeping and eating. Even though your work isn't all done, go to bed on time and get up on time. That will help you with great sleep in the future. And then limit your daytime naps. If you are going to nap, a power nap earlier in the day for 15 or 20 minutes is okay. But if you go through a whole cycle of an hour, you're going to have REM sleep, you're going to have delta wave sleep, and it's going to throw off your sleep at nighttime. Create a restful environment to prepare your mind and body for sleep. Dim the lights, maybe calming music, a bath, reading a good meditative printed book, or even journaling can be helpful. But the best cycle to be on, as far as circadian rhythm, well documented, early to bed, early to rise. How early to bed? 9 o'clock is a great goal to go to bed, and maybe getting up at around 5 if you're going to go to bed at 10, maybe getting up at 6. And then watch out for the sleep medications. Beware of using benzos for sleep, as they're highly addictive. Ambien, Lunesta, and Trazodone are also addictive, but not to the degree of benzos. So if you have to be on a sleep aid because it's so terrible, your ability to get sleep, you might want to choose one of these agents first. Or even old-fashioned Benadryl. The problem with all of these, including Benadryl, is if you're on them a long period of time, it increases your risk of dementia and Alzheimer's. And this is why we want to eventually get you away from these drugs in trying to go to sleep. If you do need a pharmaceutical, I would recommend you try Rozarum. It has no abuse potential, even at 10 times the dose, and is not associated with the development of dementia. That's what we call a melatonin agonist. Behavioral therapies actually work better than drugs. Researchers found that a few sessions of cognitive behavioral therapy, one of the gold standards of psychotherapy, more effective than a common sleep medication at bringing lasting relief to people with chronic insomnia. These researchers concluded that behavioral therapy should constitute the first line of therapy for chronic insomnia, because we don't have the side effects. And this is what you're going to be learning about in session 4, is how we can even utilize this to help us with sleep. Once again, if you're needing to take something, I would recommend the supplements before the pharmaceuticals, if at all possible. 5-HTP can be helpful, just 100 or 200 milligrams at night. Melatonin, particularly if you pulverize it and put it under your tongue, just 3 milligrams or less, can be a nice sleep aid. Tart cherries has been shown to be beneficial. Valerian is another supplement shown to be beneficial. Lemon balm is also very sedative and anxiety relieving. Lavella, we talked about that earlier, that's the Celexon. That's not sedating, but many people are not able to sleep because of their anxiety. So if we alleviate the anxiety, they could sleep. And that's why Lavella has been shown to be helpful for that. Hops is also an herb that can be helpful. Catnip is another one that's been shown to be helpful, as well as passion flower, and even the simple mineral magnesium. That's present in a lot of over-the-counter aids to help you sleep. It's called Calm, but magnesium improves serotonin production as well as melatonin production at night, and it can have some nice ability to restfully sleep. When we're speaking about sleep, we should not ignore the effects of music. Study found that over 60% of respondents use music as a sleep aid successfully, and calming music prepares your mind for rest. We call calming music a largo or a lullaby. So a lullaby is something that has one beat every 60 seconds. So that's 60 beats a minute. If it goes over 80, it's no longer a lullaby, and it's not going to put you to sleep. You can use lullabies at night very successfully, but in the daytime, we recommend you don't use lullabies, that you use energetic music that can be helpful. Music psychotherapy, in which people were encouraged to reflect on their past, present, and future while listening to classical music, has been shown to improve mood and reduce stress. Now, not all classical music will help, but it's music that has a number of principles. Just 6 sessions of classical music therapy used for 45 minutes every 2 weeks for a total of 12 weeks improved depression scores and mood in 23 to 45-year-olds who didn't even like classical music before they were randomized to this trial. It wasn't because they wanted the music, but they were willing to undergo this trial. And it's not that they hated the music, it's just that they hadn't really been seriously exposed to it, like many people have never been really exposed. But that exposure produced some significant positive benefits to their brain. These subjects showed improved scores on tests of overall mood. They had less depression, less fatigue. In other words, their energy levels improved. And once again, we saw the objective improvement in their cortisol levels going down considerably. So what were the characteristics of this music that's been shown to be so healthy? This is not something new. If you look in antiquity or history, kings in yesteryear and thousands of years ago were shown to improve their mental health by this type of music. And now it's been studied by music therapists. There's PhD programs. I got to study under Dr. Juanita McElwain, the mother of music therapy that started more PhD programs in America. And she showed in her research and other research the 6 characteristics. Here they are. The music is melodious. Maybe you can even hum the tune, but it's a beautiful melody. Simple yet attractive. Beautiful, what we call non-dissonant harmonies. A dissonant harmony is when the notes are too close and it kind of grates. Consonant harmonies are where the harmonies are further apart and it's pleasing and beautiful. One of the dissonant harmonies that's used a lot in music is called the blue note. The blue note is actually between 2 half notes. That's how close it is, and it's been shown to induce the blues. And we want to stay away from those types of harmonies. Straight rhythms. If the rhythm makes you want to get up and march around the room, that is a straight rhythm. If it wants you, it makes you want to stand up and swing your hips, that's a syncopated rhythm. We call that boom cha. Syncopated rhythms won't harm you per se unless they're continual. So in a lot of music, you have that boom cha, boom cha, boom cha. It just goes on forever. After 90 seconds, your brain chemistry starts to be adversely affected. And so if it's just a measure or two, it won't. But we don't want that continual syncopated rhythm. March rhythms, however, are healthy. And if the rhythm is less prominent than the melody and harmony, that will also be healthy for you. And if you can imagine a story behind it, it's even more impressive. So if you add all those up, it's about 7, but we have melodious and simple yet attractive kind of together there. And if you put those, that's 6. And if you have all 6 of those together, even if the music was written yesterday or today, it's healthy for you. It doesn't have to be written a long time ago. As long as it has those principles, it is going to be very healthy for your brain, mood enhancing, and if it's a lullaby, it can even help your sleep. So I want to encourage you today or tomorrow to be intentional about changing your outdoor time. I want you to increase your outdoor time in nature. I want you to decrease your screen time. And I want you to plan your physical activity, if at all possible, to be outdoors. At the same time, I want you to change your music. If you want to find music like this, we have a Nedley Spotify site. You can get on our website and see all sorts of different musical choices that will fit these 6 criteria. And these criteria can have all sorts of genres. There's more genres of classical music than all other musics combined. So you can find the right music for you. And then also be particular about choosing the best bedtime and going to bed on time and waking up on time. And you, when you wake up, get that bright light immediately or shortly after awakening for at least 30 minutes. And as you engage in these enjoyable activities together, expect a synergistic effect. All of this together is going to start working in very positive ways as you optimize your brain. Thank you very much.